For this week's colloquium, we have Nicole Younger-Halperin, who is, as I guess many people in the audience here know, also speaking as part of the conference going on this week. Nicole was a master's student in the PSI program here back in 2013, where I remember that she frequently told me to write larger on the blackboard. And then after that, she went and did her PhD at Caltech with John Preskill and got that in 2018. Following that, she was a postdoc, a ITAMP postdoc at Harvard. And then in 2021, joined NIST, where she's now a fellow at the Joint Center for Quantum Information and Computer Science, and a theoretical physicist at NIST, and adjunct assistant professor at the University of Maryland. As you may know, she just published a new book with a title similar to the title of, although not exactly the same as the title of her colloquium today. And she'll tell us about quantum steampunk, so whenever you're ready, Nicole, take it away.
Thanks for the introduction. Thanks very much for the invitation to speak here. It's really a pleasure to be back at Perimeter. I keep saying this, but it really does feel like I've come home. And also thank you especially to the conference organizers for taking a risk on someone who is outside their subfields. I hope that this focus on quantum information and quantum thermodynamics is useful. I'd like to begin with a technical term, namely steampunk. Steampunk is a genre of literature, art, and film. Set in the late 19th century, it encompasses all of the romanticism of the Victorian era, then cranks up the technological level to 11. The steampunk works feature Victorian settings, some of the earliest factories, grimy cities, people in top hats or full skirts, together with futuristic technologies, such as time machines, flying ships, and automata. This combination of old and new creates a wonderful sense of nostalgia and adventure. So fans dress up in these steampunk costumes and go to steampunk conventions. I like to say they dream it. Quantum information thermodynamicists live it. Let me break down that term. Thermodynamics is a branch of physics, chemistry, and engineering that was developed during the 1800s, namely the steampunk era, motivated by the Industrial Revolution, driven by steam engines, whose operation, whose work, people started wanting to understand. Thermodynamics is the study of energy, so the different forms that energy can be in, and the possible transformations amongst those forms. Thermodynamics was initially motivated by technologies like the steam engine. So it was practical-minded. But practical questions led to fundamental questions like, why does time flow in only one direction? Thermodynamics was developed to describe the cutting-edge technology of the day, which was large and classical. Today's cutting-edge technologies look a little bit different. Here's an image of a single strand of DNA. You can take optical tweezers made from lasers, and trap one end of the strand, and then stretch the other strand through a given distance. You can measure the work required to stretch the strand through a given distance. Of course, many of the technologies that interest us are quantum. This is the dilution refrigerator in which either Google or IBM cools down one of its quantum computers. And cooling is a thermodynamic process. Of course, we're interested in information processing technologies and so how information is closely related to energy. And now we're interested in out of equilibrium systems. I mean, apart from you and me, we as living beings are far from equilibrium. But a lot of conventional thermodynamics describes equilibrium system, which is a very quiet state. People, for instance, in labs commonly nowadays take some quantum many-body system and sort of whap it so it becomes out of equilibrium, and they see how it settles back down. So all of these settings are quite different from the conventional thermodynamic setting that we saw earlier, But thermodynamic concepts such as heat and work remain relevant. We need a toolkit for updating the thermodynamics of the 1800s for the 21st century. Quantum information theory offers such a toolkit. Probably most people in this audience could define quantum information theory better than I could, but just to ensure that we're all on the same page, by quantum information theory, I mean the study of how we can use quantum phenomena to process information in ways in which we can't with just classical systems. By process information, I mean solve computational problems, communicate information, secure information cryptographically, and store information in memories. By quantum phenomena, well, there are many different levels of quantumness, but some phenomena that are all somehow associated with quantum physics include entanglement, the non-commutation of operators, the discreteness of spectra, how if you measure a quantum system, you disturb it, and more. Quantum information theory has provided this wonderful toolkit that many people here at Perimeter are applying to many different spheres of science to understand them through a new lens. So, condensed matter, high energy physics, computer science, and thermodynamics. If you take the thermodynamics of the 1800s and reimagine it for the 21st century using quantum information theory, then you get this wonderful blend of old and new that is modern quantum thermodynamics. In quantum thermodynamics, we take the laws of thermodynamics from the 1800s and 1900s, we reformulate them so that we can see how they are consistent with quantum theory and especially the processing of information, and understand them on more fine-grained levels, also generalize them away from their original settings. We also ask, what can we do with quantum systems and thermodynamics? We know that quantum phenomena can benefit information processing, such as computing. Just as there are information processing tasks, there are thermodynamic tasks, such as powering engines and charging batteries and refrigerating. Also, we can ask which features of thermodynamics or thermalization are really non-classical. This combination of questions and its applications I call quantum steampunk. As was just mentioned, that's the subject of a book that I published last month, Quantum Steampunk, which is really an introduction to quantum information theoretic thermodynamics. I'm going to mention it a couple of times during the rest of the talk. Here's where I'd like to go. First, I'd like to convince you that it makes some sense to put together quantum information theory with thermodynamics. Then I'll argue that both work and information can serve as resources in both computation and energy processing. Then I'd like to take a little dive into one subfield of quantum thermodynamics that's actively undergoing research today, that of quantum many-body or quantum thermal machines or quantum engines. I'll talk about an engine based on the existence of certain phases of quantum matter. Then I'll talk about the opportunities for this field. Why does it make sense to put together quantum information theory with thermodynamics to modernize thermodynamics? By the way, when I was making this talk, basically to amuse myself, I peppered it with a bunch of steampunk images. So if steampunk isn't your aesthetic, then I apologize, but you know, this kept me entertained, so hopefully it'll keep you awake. I see information theory as centered on one big question, in large part, namely, how efficiently can we process information? And the answer I think of as the liver of information theory. When I was in high school, I had a biology teacher who said, if you ever don't know the answer to a question on a test of mine, write down liver. Because the liver performs a ridiculous number of functions in the human body. So if you don't know the answer to a biology question and you answer liver, you have an anomalously high probability of being correct. Similarly, if someone asks you, what is the optimal efficiency with which we can perform some information processing task? And you answer a function of an entropy, you have an anomalously high probability of being correct. By an entropy, I mean a function within a large class of such functions of a quantum states or a probability distribution. It somehow quantifies our uncertainty about the outcome of a measurement of the states or the value of a variable distributed according to this probability distribution. To go a little further, I'd like to provide a quick review. Probably most people here are familiar with qubits, but there are people from many different fields here, and I hope there are a number of students here. So this is just a little bit of quick background. The qubit is the basic unit of quantum information, the quantum analog of the bits, the basic unit of classical information, which can be realized by a system that can be in one of two possible states, such as right or left, or zero or one. We realize qubits with quantum two-level systems, a favorite example of which is the spin degree of freedom of an electron, or particle that has a spin quantum number 1/2. We represent qubits, well, we in quantum information theory often represent qubits with density operators represented often by rho. We can think of this as a matrix relative to our favorite basis. Technically, it's a trace one positive semi-definite linear operator. By trace one, I mean if we measure the state, we'll get some outcome. By positive semi-definite, we mean if we take the matrix and calculate its eigenvalues, we'll find they're all real and all at least zero. We represent qubit states with points on or in the Bloch sphere. A particularly simple class of states consists of pure states represented by outer products or vectors in the Hilbert space. This is represented geometrically by an arrow that goes all the way out to the Bloch sphere from the center. So the upward pointing arrow I'll use to represent a zero, the downward pointing arrow I'll use to represent a one. And of course, a quantum state can be in, or a qubit can be in any superposition of these two states. Another class of states consists of mixed states, which can't be expressed as just kets or just outer products. A mixed state is the state of a system that's entangled with some other system. Geometrically, it's represented by an arrow inside the Bloch sphere. The shorter the arrow, the more entangled our system is. A favorite example from thermodynamics is the quantum thermal state. Here, beta is the inverse temperature of the environment with which our system is exchanging energy. H is a Hamiltonian, and Z is a partition function. So let's look at one of these entropies face to face and see that an entropy is the optimal efficiency with which we perform some information processing task. Suppose that I want to send a message to Rob. We agree in advance on the letters that I might send. Rob knows the probability that I'll send an A, the probability that I'll send a B, and so on. So from his perspective, I'm sending some states in which the possible letters are weighted by their probabilities. So suppose that for mathematical convenience, I send many, many copies, N, of this state, or a tensor product. Suppose that I want to squeeze the message into as few qubits as possible. I'm performing the information processing task of data compression. How many qubits do I need? The answer is given to us by Schumacher's theorem. In the limit, as the number of copies that I send approaches infinity, the number of qubits that I need per copy of the states equals the von Neumann entropy, the negative of the trace of rho log rho, so one of our favorite entropies. If the information processing task has a different character, say I'm sending only one copy or only five copies, or I allow for an error probability in Rob's decoding, then different entropies will come into play. We've seen that an entropy is useful for quantifying the efficiency with which we perform some information processing task. Why is it called an entropy? We get this name from Claude Shannon, founder of information theory. This is a Google Doodle from his 100th birthday from a few years ago. He said that John von Neumann, the great Hungarian-American mathematical physicist, said to him, "You should call it entropy for two reasons. In the first place, your uncertainty function has been used in statistical mechanics under that name, so it already has a name. In the second place, and more important, No one knows what entropy really is, so in a debate, you will always have the advantage. Personally, that's why I do quantum information theory and thermodynamics. Indeed, here's the fundamental relation of statistical mechanics, and here's the statistical mechanical entropy. In statistical mechanics, the entropy represents how spread across phase space we think of as a system, we think of a system as being. So suppose that we have some classical many-body system, such as a classical gas in a box. We don't know where all the particles are, we don't know all of their momenta. So instead of trying to specify its microstates, we attribute a probability density to all of phase space. Now, how spread out the probability density is given by the entropy and represents our uncertainty about what the system's configuration is. So in statistical mechanics, or closely related thermodynamics, as an information theory, entropy is useful for representing our uncertainty. The thermodynamics and information theory share this very important characteristic that helps us put them together. Now I'd like to show that it's actually useful to put them together. So hopefully by now you're convinced that it makes some sense. Now we want to see what we can get out of one from the other. Let's see that both information and work are resources in both computation and thermodynamics. The first illustration of this is very beautifully illustrated in a story called Szilard's Engine. So Szilard was another great Hungarian-American physicist. He showed that if you have information, you can use it to turn heat into work. Heat is random energy, it's uncoordinated, it's not directly doing something useful. Work is coordinated energy that we can directly use to power a factory or lift a weight. So we can use information to turn what's kind of useless into something useful. Suppose that, once again, we have a gas in a box. This is a really, really simple gas. It consists of just one particle. And it exchanges heat with its surroundings, which have a fixed temperature, through the walls of the box. Suppose we start out with one bit of information, but we know that the particle is in the right-hand side of the box rather than the left-hand side. And we can slide a partition into the box, tie a rope to the partition, and tie an Acme anvil to the rope, and then unfix the partition so that it can slide. The particle is going to punch the partition. It's going to keep punching the partition until the partition reaches the left-hand side of the box. At this point, we've lifted the weight. So the weight gains gravitational potential energy. We've done useful work on it. Where did that work come from? It used to be heat that came from the heat bath. How much work can we perform, at least on average? This is pressure volume type work, so the work equals this integral. We all remember the ideal gas law. Pressure times volume equals the number of particles times Boltzmann's constant times the temperature. We can solve for the pressure in terms of the volume and substitute into our integral. So I'm integrating from V over 2 to V because the particle began confined to half the box but ends up able to be anywhere in the full box. So we integrate, we evaluate the limits, and we find that the work we can perform is Boltzmann's constant times the temperature times log 2. So we do this useful work, but we've forfeited the bit of information. We now have no idea where in the box the particle is. So we've traded our information for work. We can reverse this process and perform what's called Landauer erasure. Suppose that we don't know where in the box the particle is, and we want to reset the particle so that it has a nice, well-defined position. This is like taking a messy sheet of scrap paper that's been scribbled on randomly and erasing it to a nice, clean state. We start out, or we have to start off, with the capacity to perform work, so a lifted weight. And we can slide a partition into the box near the left-hand wall, and push the partition to the box's center so that the particle is trapped in the right-hand side. Since we're compressing a gas, we have to perform work, and the work is at least the amount that we could have gotten out of Szilard's engine, because you can't get out more work than you would have to spend to reset the system. There is no perpetuum mobile. So we return the bits to a known state. We erase the bits, this time trading work for information. This story has deep implications for the relationship between computation and thermodynamics. Because suppose that we want to compute. Eventually, we'll run out of scrap paper. The universe doesn't have an infinite supply of scrap paper, so we'll have to erase them. According to Landauer, erasure costs work. So computation has an intrinsic thermodynamic cost. When I first learned that, it blew my mind. Because who would think, just looking at the two on the face of them, that information and energy have anything to do with each other? But they turn out to be very closely bound up. I've been telling a story about a classical gas in a box, but this colloquium is called quantum steampunk, so let's bring in some quantum physics. Again, I'm going to provide a really quick review of some topics that are probably known to lots of people here, but perhaps not quite everybody. We're going to be using entanglements, which manifests in correlations between outcomes of measurements. These are stronger than any correlations we can achieve with classical systems. Favorite example that we're going to use shortly is a singlet, so 0, 1, -1, 0. For instance, suppose that Latham and I have particles, sorry, Latham, and we bring them together and perform some operation on them so that they're entangled, and then we bring them far apart. If we measure either system locally, we have no idea which outcome we'll obtain. So if just Latham measures, he doesn't suppose that he has a spin, he measures the spin z component, he doesn't know whether he'll receive the up or the down outcome. If each of us measures locally, we can predict something about the joint outcome. If we perform the right measurements, for instance, if we both measure whether our spins are pointing upward or downward, and if I get the up outcome, he'll get the down outcome. If I get the down outcome, he'll get the up outcome. And because we're talking about entanglements, there is some measurement we can perform jointly on the pair of particles so that we can predict the outcome with certainty in advance. So there's something that's not in my particle, not in Latham's particle, and not in the sum of the two addressed individually, but in the whole. So let's use that in thermodynamics. Suppose that we want to reset not a classical bit of information, but a qubit. Suppose that this qubit is entangled with some memory, and again, we have a fixed temperature bath around that we can use as we see fit. Then we can erase the qubits while keeping the memory's reduced state fixed, while extracting net positive work. This should be surprising, since we just saw that erasure costs net positive work. The idea is to sort of burn the correlations between the system and the memory. In more detail, we have these two qubits that are entangled, suppose they're maximally entangled. We can perform a Bell measurement on them. A Bell measurement has four possible outcomes, and if we know which state we have, then we know which outcome we'll get. So we know one of four possibilities. So we have some bits of information. The number of bits is log 4, 2 bits. So we have these 2 bits of information. We can run Szilard's engine twice. That gives us 2 units of work. Now we need one of those units of work to erase the qubit of interest we saw according to Landauer. And that leaves us with one extra unit of work. So that's how we can erase while getting out work by burning entanglements, burning being in scare quotes. So entanglement serves kind of as a thermodynamic fuel when it's together with heat. In summary, we can use information to turn somewhat useless heat into useful work. And information, including quantum information, such as entanglements, as well as work, can both serve as resources in thermodynamics and computation. Does anybody have questions at this point? In the back. Do people need to throw a cube up to speak? Thanks, Latham.
Thank you. Sorry, could you go back one slide? Okay, so I didn't quite understand the argument here. Could you just go through it one more time?
Yeah, we have two qubits that mm-hmm. are in a known entangled state, mm-hmm. and suppose the state is a maximally entangled state. Mm-hmm. Then there is a measurement that we can perform such that we can predict the outcome with certainty in advance, namely a Bell measurement. Mm-hmm. That has four possible outcomes, and we know which one of those outcomes will be obtained.
Okay.
So the amount of information we have in advance is one of four outcomes. The number of bits of information is log base 2 of the number of possible outcomes. So log base 2 of 4, which is 2 bits.
Right.
We take each of these bits, and on each bit, we run Szilard's engine, which turns one bit into one unit of work. So we get 2 units of work, 2 times kt log 2. And we saw that according to the Landauer story, we need one of those units of work, just kt log 2, to erase. So we use up that one unit of work, and we're left with one unit of work. So we erase the qubits while gaining kt log 2 of work.
So in the end, they won't be entangled anymore.
Right. So we're sort of burning the correlations between the qubits.
Okay. All right. That's great. Thanks.
So that's why we're saying that entanglement is also quantum information can serve as a resource in thermodynamics.
Okay.
Any other questions? All right, then let's move on from backgrounds and get into some of the work that's some of a subfield of quantum thermodynamics that's under active research today. A subfield of quantum thermodynamics is the subfield of quantum thermal machines, quantum engines, quantum refrigerators, quantum batteries, quantum ratchets. I'm going to talk about an engine that's based on the existence of 2 quantum phases of matter, in particular, many-body localization. Many-body localization, I think, has a horribly long name with too many syllables. Sometimes we call it MBL, and I try not to use acronyms in talks, but I will need this one for a reason that will be clear later. This is a phase of a quantum many-body system, such as a chain of qubits. Let's call the number of qubits n. This chain can evolve under a Hamiltonian that has the following structure. There are 2 terms of interest. One term is a Heisenberg interaction between nearest neighbors, sigma j dot sigma j plus 1. This enables 2 nearest neighbors to flip in tandem and also repel each other. Let's say that the hopping frequency is J. The other term is called the disorder potential. It's an external field imposed on our system. If our system is realized with cold atoms in an optical lattice, then it's the optical lattice that provides the disorder potential. And it's this jagged, random-looking thing. We can think of this as a field pointing along the z direction. Now, how do we construct it, for instance, in numerical simulation, since we're theorists here? We would, to construct the disorder potential at each site j, we would pick a random number, h sub j, between negative 1 and 1, and then multiply it by the overall disorder strength, little h. Suppose that this little h, this disorder strength, is much greater than the hopping frequency. And we can think of these qubits pointing upward or downward instead as particles that are present or absent, since the qubits are equivalent to spinless fermions via a Jordan-Wigner transformation. If the disorder strength is very high and we measure the particles' positions, then the particles will approximately hang around in those positions for a long time afterward. This behavior is in contrast with the behavior of one of our favorite equilibrating systems, a classical gas. Again, a gas, sorry. Suppose that we have a gas whose particles are all clumped together in one corner of their container. Then shortly afterward, the particles will spread all across the box. They are very much not going to hang around in the same locations. In this way, and in one other way that I'll talk about shortly, many body localization behaves athermally, not at the thermal equilibrium. To a thermodynamicist, athermal systems are useful. They can be resources in thermodynamic tasks. We can see this through a simple example from undergraduate statistical physics. Suppose that we're in a fixed temperature environment with access to a giant heat bath at a temperature T sub H. And suppose that suddenly we're given a much colder system. We can let heat flow from one to the other, and from the heat flow we can extract work. You know, work is valuable since we can use it to power our cars. So we can think of this system not at thermal equilibrium relative to the ambient temperature as a resource. So can we take advantage of the athermality of many body localization? Of course, the answer is yes, otherwise I would not be giving this talk like this. I argued yes with my collaborators in this paper. Christopher White is now a postdoc at the University of Maryland. Sarangopalakrishnan, I described in my book as specializing in everything that involves quantum many-body systems, as well as in a blend of snideness, dark humor, and resignation that's oddly endearing. Some of you might know Sarang. Don't worry, he was actually okay with this description being published. And Gil Raphael sparked this project by asking me a question over a cup of coffee. I've been studying this, he said, this many-body localization, this phase of quantum matter for a number of years now, but what is it good for? And of course, all good thermodynamics projects should start over a cup of coffee, since we so often use a cup of coffee as an explanation for the second law of thermodynamics. What we came up with is a construct that we call the MBL mobile. So that's why I needed the acronym earlier on. It is a quantum many-body engine that can be ratcheted between the many-body localized phase and a quite different, more thermal phase. We designed an auto cycle for this engine to be run through. An auto cycle is like the Carnot cycle that we usually spend more time on in our thermodynamics classes. It consists of four strokes. The auto cycle happens to be the cycle that's used in car engines. Two of the strokes are isentropic. Who remembers what isentropic means? In the front. Constant entropy, yes. How about isochoric? This one is tougher.
Volume,
good, excellent. So two strokes are isentropic and two keep the volume constant in the classical version of this cycle. Our cycle is going to be illustrated not on the traditional pressure volume diagram on which we see many engine cycles, but because the pressure and the volume aren't the variables that are most relevant to this quantum many body system. So instead, I'll illustrate this engine by putting on the x-axis the ratio of the disorder strength to the hopping frequency in the Hamiltonian that we saw earlier. Remember, if the hopping frequency is low, then the system has no reason, if the disorder potential is low, relative to the hopping frequency, there's no reason for this system to be localized. So it's either shallowly localized or, in an extreme case, actually in a whole other phase of matter, which we think of as thermal. And I would be happy to give details about what I mean by thermal. For those familiar with it, it obeys the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. If the disorder strength is very high, then the system is deep in the localized regime. Along the y-axis, I'll illustrate the energies in the many-body Hamiltonian. We're going to take advantage of a difference in the energy gap statistics of these two regimes. We're not interested in just one Hamiltonian. We're actually interested in a whole class of Hamiltonians. Earlier, when I showed that detail expression for the Hamiltonian, there was a set of random variables, H sub j, determining the disorder strength. Different realizations of those variables lead to different Hamiltonians in this class. Suppose that we randomly pick a Hamiltonian from this class, and we know that we calculate its energies, and it has some energy, E, around the middle of the spectrum. Right above that energy is a gap. What is the probability that that gap is of size delta? That quantity is really the core of energy gap statistics. And energy gap statistics differ between the deeply localized and the shallowly localized regimes, especially the thermal phase. In the less localized regime, a typical gap is about like the average gap, which I'll call average delta, and I'll assume for convenience is constant across the cycle. In the deeply localized regime, small gaps and large gaps occur much more frequently. So this is a second way in which many body localization has an athermal property. Its energy gap statistics are quite different from the energy gap statistics of the thermal phase, which is a phase in which particles spread out and information spreads out all across the many body system quite quickly. We're going to use the energy gap statistics in our cycle. We start the cycle with the system in the shallowly localized regime at thermal equilibrium with a hot bath at a temperature T sub H. So this system is described by this thermal state density operator. We can take advantage in our analysis of the statistical interpretation of the density operator. We can imagine that every trial begins with the system on one particular energy eigenstate that is selected randomly according to the canonical probability distribution. And then in our analysis, we just, at the end of our analysis, average over the energy eigenstates. At the beginning of the cycle, we disconnect the engine from the bath, and we tune the Hamiltonian from shallowly localized to deeply localized, ratcheting up the disorder potential. In an initial approximation, we can suppose that the tuning is quantum adiabatic, very, very, very slow, so that the system always remains on the same instantaneous energy level. Of course, this is only an approximation, and we calculated corrections from finite speed tuning. The energy of the system, of the engine, is moving downward. So energy is coming out of the system. The system is not connected to the heat bath anymore. So by the first law of thermodynamics, what comes out, since it's not work, is heat. Excuse me, other way around. Since it's not heat, it's work. So during this tuning stroke, the engine performs positive work. It ends up here. During the second stroke, we hook up the system to a much colder bath that we demand has a small bandwidth WB, much less than the average gap. The bath can, with high probability, accept only small quanta of energy so that the system can drop across this small gap, but not the next large gap. In doing so, the engine outputs an amount Q of heat. Then we tune the Hamiltonian back from deeply localized to shallowly localized. Again, the system, the engine, is moving downward in energy space. So again, it's losing energy that comes out as work. Then during the final stroke, we hook the system, the engine, back up to the hot bath to let it reset. And on average, the engine will intake a positive amount of heat. Across this four-stroke cycle, we've had two strokes during which the engine outputs a positive amount of work. That's because we designed this cycle such that the engine traverses this trapezoid in this clockwise direction, and the narrow snout is over here. The narrow snout can be over here because we were able to take advantage of how there are more small gaps in the deeply localized regime than in the shallowly localized regime. So we were able to use the athermality of the energy gap statistics of the many-body localized regime. Does anybody have questions about that?
What if we had started from the third excited state?
The question is, what if we had started from the third excited state for those on Zoom? We could have started from that state. The engine would have, during stroke one, gone up along this energy level, and then it would have been connected to the cold bath. The cold bath's bandwidth is just about this, so the engine would not have been able to drop down here. Instead, during stroke, so the engine would just stay here during strokes two. During stroke three, it would have gone right back. So during stroke one, the engine performs positive energy. Its energy is increasing, so it's taking in energy, it's taking in work. But during stroke three, the engine goes right back down, so it gives up the work that it absorbed. So the engine nets zero. You can do this analysis with many different structures of gaps and locations of energy levels, and it turns out that in a lot of cases, the engine does an amount zero of work during a cycle, but there are, because of these anomalously small gaps, there are cycles in which the engine does positive work. So the average work performed by the engine is positive.
So how do you know it's positive? Do you know what the probability distribution of the initial state is?
Yes. So this is given by the energy gap statistics of the thermal phase, which I can show in a bonus slide if you want later. And you can do this analysis of saying, what if the engine starts here or here or here? What if the gaps are like this or like this or like this? And in those cases, you can analyze them case by case. And in each case, the engine performs zero network or positive network. So on average, it performs positive network. So this is a much better illustration than I have of the engine. This is by the steampunk artist Todd Cahill. You might notice a problem, namely, suppose that we denote by n the number of sites in our engine. The energy band has a width that scales like n linearly, but the number of energy levels is exponentially large in n. The number of energy levels is almost the same as the number of energy gaps. So the number of energy gaps is exponential. And the size of the average gap decreases exponentially as the global system grows. That average energy gap upper bounds the average work performed by the engine. And the size of the average gap approaches zero in the thermodynamic limit as n approaches infinity. So it looks like our engine does no work. We can get around this problem by using that other athermal property of many-body localization. We can build mesoscopic sub-engines that consist of about 10 sites. The power is going to be exponentially small only in this constant. And we can put sub-engines next to each other so that there's some total number of sites n total. And the power is going to grow linearly in the number of sub-engines and so linearly in the total number of sites. And this works because what happens in a sub-engine stays in a sub-engine, because many-body localization is naturally localized. We can put these sub-engines relatively close together without worrying that energy, information, and particles will stray from one into the other, because things tend to stay put in this athermal localized regime. So the engine can scale robustly due to that second athermal property of many-body localization. We evaluate an engine by calculating its power and efficiency. We calculated that the average work performed per cycle is like the total number of engines, which scales with the total number of sites, times the bandwidth WB of the cold bath. Then there are some corrections subtracted off because the cold bath isn't going to be at zero temperature, and the hot bath might not be infinitely hot, so they're not completely ideal. Also, as I mentioned, we don't tune our Hamiltonians actually infinitely slowly, so during the tuning strokes, the engine can jump between energy levels occasionally. So that's an analytical expression, but what does it actually look like? We estimated the power of this engine in an order of magnitude type of way, supposing that the engine is realized with silicon doped with phosphorus. And this platform had, at the time of the writing of our paper at least, not been used to realize many-body localization, but a different type of localization, Anderson localization, which is also can also be used in our engine, even though it's not quite as convenient. We estimated that the power is about 10 to the negative 16th watts. What does that mean? We compared this engine with another small engine, the engine of a bacterium that powers its flagellum. We found that the many-body localized engine might be about 10 times more powerful. We can also calculate the power density, the power per unit volume. We found that to be about 100 kilowatts per meter cubed. What does that mean? It's about a tenth the power density of the engine in a car. So we probably won't have many-body localized engines in our garages anytime soon, but the MBL Mobile performs not too badly. We can also check these results in numerical simulations done by my co-author, Christopher. Here we had a one-dimensional chain of 12 qubits simulated with exact diagonalization. Our prediction is that the total work on average done by the engine is proportional to the cold bath's bandwidth and approximately equals it. Here's the plots. Along the x-axis, we have the cold bath's bandwidth in units of the average gap. Along the y-axis, we have the average work performed, also in units of the average gap. These red points represent the numerical simulations, and the blue line represents the theory curve. This gray region is actually the only region in which the parameters are such that our assumptions and our argument hold, and so we actually expect the prediction to work, but the numerical simulations match the prediction in a much wider regime. The efficiency is the work performed by the engine divided by the heat absorbed during the stroke in which, on average, the engine absorbs a positive amount of heat. That turns out to be 1 minus the cold bath bandwidth over twice the average gap. We assumed from the start that the cold bath bandwidth is much smaller than the average gap, so the efficiency can be close to 1. What's more, the efficiency can equal the efficiency of an ideal gas, conventional auto engine. That auto engine has a known efficiency given here. The heat capacities of this gas at constant pressure and constant volume are C sub P and C sub V. This gas is expanded and compressed to volumes V plus and V minus. What do I mean by this equality? Suppose that I am a conventional thermodynamic agent, or I have an ideal gas auto engine. It has some heat capacities. I can choose volumes V plus and V minus between which to expand and contract it, and I can operate it ideally at this efficiency. And suppose that Cheyenne is a quantum thermodynamicist, and I can hand my numbers to him. He can choose a cold bath bandwidth and an average gap such that his engine achieves the same efficiency. That's what I mean by this equality. As a sanity check, both of these efficiencies are no greater than the Carnot efficiency, which is the greatest efficiency achievable by an engine that operates just by running between two baths at different temperatures. That is a good thing, because if we broke the Carnot bound, then we would basically be violating the second law of thermodynamics, and we probably would have done something wrong. This MBL Mobile has, relative to particular competitors, a few advantages that we've seen. First, it can scale robustly because of one of its athermal properties, namely localization. Relatedly, it can have a relatively high power density because we can pack the sub-engines close together, also because of localization. It's also relatively reliable. Suppose that you run an engine many times, then you'll obtain different amounts of work in different trials. It's useful to have a reliable engine whose work is basically always about the same. The fluctuations in the work across trials for this engine are relatively low because of the other athermal property of many-body localization, namely the athermal nature of its energy gap statistics. Also, this engine has relatively few worst-case trials. If you run an engine enough times, eventually you'll get out a net negative amount of work. So the engine will absorb a net positive amount of work. I call that a worst-case trial. This engine has relatively few of those, again, because of the athermal energy gap statistics of many-body localization. Any questions about the MBL mobile at this point? Yes.
Is there a lower bound for the mesoscopic scale that realistic? Because you said that it has to be about 10 sides, but of course it would be more efficient to make it smaller.
The question for those on Zoom is there a lower bound on the size of a mesoscale sub-engine? According to numerical simulations, more or less the smallest size at which we can see the different energy gap statistics is 8. So this should be at least 8 sites long. Any other questions?
I don't understand why the efficiency is less than that of the carbon cycle.
The question is, why is the efficiency of the MBL mobile and the conventional auto engine less than the efficiency of the Carnot engine? The inequality in this case is non-strict, so the efficiencies of the auto engines can, in ideal conditions, equal the ideal efficiency of the Carnot engine. And the reason is that is Carnot's theorem, that the greatest efficiency achievable by any heat engine that uses just two different heat baths at two different temperatures is this Carnot engine, or excuse me, this Carnot efficiency. That's a result in thermodynamics. And these two engines fall under that category of engines that operate with just two baths at two different temperatures.
Yeah, I understood that. What I was confused about was, what is the equivalent of TC and pH in your
lab? The question is about the meanings of T sub C and T sub H in our engine cycle. During our engine cycle, during strokes 2 and 4, we had our engine interact with heat baths at temperatures T sub C and T sub H. So those are the temperatures. Right.
But that you could have picked it to be whatever you wanted.
We can choose those two temperatures to be what we wish. So one should be colder than the other for the engine to be useful.
Your quantum entanglement and correlations take place in space-time. How do you take account of the environmental decoherence of your qubit information in your simulations?
We were simulating a closed quantum many-body system. We were simulating the ideal case that is realized experimentally a great deal nowadays. So in simulations, there are in many cases a closed quantum many-body system, and we want to study what happens to entanglement and energy and other conserved charges just within that system. And then we can move from the simulations of theory to the experiment and say, well, the experimentalists are going to try to close their quantum many-body system as well as possible. No experimentalist is ever going to succeed in doing that unless the experiment is the entire universe. So in that case, if we're trying to model imperfect experiments, then we'll take this model of the ideal closed quantum many-body system and add in channels for decoherence. That wasn't something that we were going to do at this point because we were just doing the theory. If someone would like to realize this experimentally, there have been people who have expressed interest, and we have been studying the decoherence more in that setting. But this is just a theory study.
So it's just theoretical at present.
Yes, it's just theoretical. But many-body localization has now been realized on a number of experimental platforms, such as ultra-cold atoms and nitrogen vacancy centers. So this is viable, and there is actually a team that has superconducting qubits that is working on trying to realize this. there are a lot of opportunities for quantum thermodynamics. One of the most exciting opportunities, in my opinion, is one that's discussed a little bit in this paper. I've talked about one subfield of quantum thermodynamics in detail after that very broad introduction, namely quantum thermal machines. But there are many, many other subfields of resource theories and fluctuation relations and open quantum systems and much, much more. So there's this entire landscape. But quantum thermodynamics is within a broader landscape of many different subfields of science in which people care about, in some ways, quantum physics, information, and energy. I think that it's a particularly exciting opportunity for the field at this point is to go outside of the field and talk to the neighbors. That's what I've been doing for most of the past few years. We could potentially take tools of quantum information theoretic thermodynamics and use them to answer pre-existing questions in other fields or discover new questions. For instance, I mentioned that my collaborator Gil came to me and said, oh, many body localization is interesting, but what's it good for? Also, other fields have wonderful toolkits for analyzing thermalization in, say, closed quantum many-body systems. But there's still a difference between what those subfields do and what's done in quantum thermodynamics. I found it really fruitful to bring these subfields' tools together and integrate them, see what we can learn from one about the other. Also, something that I think is sort of compelling historically is that thermodynamics grew up together with the Industrial Revolution, which was extremely practical. Quantum thermodynamics has provided wonderful fundamental theoretical insights. It's an interesting challenge to see if it can also go hand in hand with technological developments. In summary, we saw that quantum information theory is a useful toolkit for reimagining the thermodynamics from many decades ago for today's physics. We saw that both information and work serve as resources in both information processing and thermodynamic tasks. We looked at one active subfield of quantum thermodynamics and saw an MBL mobile based on many-body localization, a phase of matter that's athermal in two ways. We constructed an auto cycle and analyzed its power and efficiency. We also saw that much is left to be done. In case you're hooked, I recommend these two reviews at the top here. They were originally written in 2015, and this field is moving really quickly, so a lot has been done since then, but they provide great overviews. I've also mentioned this book. It provides the basic physics, like what we would talk about over lunch at the Black Hole Bistro, now that I see that the scraps of paper and pencils have been removed so that we can no longer write equations to each other. You can also play the game of spot your colleagues, for instance, if you know Serang. Once again, if we take quantum information theory and use it to re-envision the thermodynamics of the 1800s for the 21st century, we get this wonderful blend of old and new that is quantum steampunk. Again, steampunk fans dream it, quantum information thermodynamicists live it. Thank you.
Okay, great, thank you. So are there any questions in the room or on Zoom from students first? Student questions? Students broadly defined? All right.
You mentioned about biological relevance. Can you give one example, like photosynthesis or exciton transport? How what you described is relevant there?
How does it fit in? Yes. This is an example, or I can give an example that I, I had the privilege and pleasure of working with a chemist a few years ago, David Limmer at UC Berkeley. He had this question. He studies molecular switches, photoisomers. These are, for instance, in our eyes. They are in one configuration, and if they receive a photon, they have the opportunity to switch to another configuration. He wanted to develop a general, simple thermodynamic style bound on the probability of switching. There are very detailed models for photoisomers. They're tough to model. They are small, they're quantum, they undergo non-adiabatic processes, they're far from equilibrium. So computations can cost a lot of resources, models can be detailed, and they can also involve some assumptions that we might actually not want to make. We used resource theory. The resource theory framework is a toolkit in quantum information theory that's been used a lot in quantum thermodynamics. We modeled this molecule within a resource theory for thermodynamics, and we took a few select theorems from the quantum thermodynamics literature and evaluated them on this molecule to develop this simple general thermodynamic style bound on the probability of switching.
All right, so I don't want to hold up the conference. Let's maybe time for one more question if there's one either in the room or on Zoom.
So I just wonder, to what extent do you need the strict MBL in the thermodynamic limit? I'm asking because of the recent discussion around the avalanche instability and so on.
Right. We were thinking here more about large finite size systems than about the thermodynamic limits, because even though we are theorists, we have in mind possible experimental realizations. It would be nice if an MBL mobile could actually be a useful engine in some setting. So we were thinking about realizable systems, namely large but finite systems.